straight to hell by the Clash. And their drummer, Joe Strummer, of the Clash, was born on this day in 1952. As we do our musical interludes with Days in This History. We are joined here by Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist and public health consultant, assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University, to co-host this first hour with me. Good to have you back, Lawrence.
Good morning. Power to the people.
And we are joined by Dr. Jeffrey Smith, assistant professor of politics and advocacy in the Milano School of International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy at the New School in New York City. Wrote an article in New Republic, which we found, which was just amazing, called "You Can't Understand Ferguson Without First Understanding These Three Things," reflections from a former state senator from St. Louis. He represented St. Louis in the Missouri Senate. And Dr. Clarence Lang joins us. He's associate professor of African and African-American studies and American Studies at the University of Kansas, an associate editor of the Journal of African American History, author of Grassroots at the Gateway, Class Politics and the Black Freedom Struggle in St. Louis, 1936-1975, and co-editor of Anti-Communism and the African American Freedom Movement, Another Side of the Story. So, gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you both with us here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you both. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. Write to us here at talk at steinershow.org. And you can also log onto our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We thought the history piece was very important to get into to understand the backdrop of all of this. Now, Jeffrey Smith only has 5 or 10 minutes to stay with us in this fix. He's taking a break on his travels to pull over to talk to us. So let me start with you, Jeffrey Smith, and I invite Lawrence to jump in with a question as well. So talk about the piece you wrote and why you wrote it and what the heart of it is.
So why did I write it? I wrote it because the TV images that are conveyed across the country and across the world, they reflect a snapshot in time, you know, a small percentage of the people who are out protesting. And, of course, the more violent, you know, things that they do, the more likely they are to get on TV. And those are the images that people see. They see a snapshot, but they don't understand the years, decades, really, of frustration that are being released here this week. And so I tried to give a little perspective on some of the, you know, the complex mix of public policy and private decisions that have gone into this powder keg, you know, that we're seeing explode right now.
And one of the things that you talked about, which I thought was very, very important, you tell the history of this small black town and how it began and how this affected directly on Ferguson and the politics of white supremacy around Ferguson.
Yeah, that's right. There was a town next door to Ferguson called Kinloch, and it was a very proud town. It was an all-black town for many years, and it was actually home to the original St. Louis Airport, and it was where some of the very first flights ever took off from. So it's a very notable location from a historical perspective. But unfortunately, whites voted long ago, I think it was in 1916 or so, to split off from that area. It increasingly, it's a long story, but because of some public policy decisions, they decided that they would sort of evacuate Kinloch and make room for airport expansion and sort of noise mitigation. They broke up this town. Many of the people who lived in this town were displaced, ended up in Ferguson, actually, and many ended up in Canfield Green, the apartment complex where Mike Brown lost his life. So there's, it's a situation where that is incredibly tragic, but there's a lot of explanations for it if you understand more about St. Louis politics. The fragmentation of St. Louis into 90 different little towns, municipalities in the county, leads to a situation where these tiny towns, they've all got their own police force, and they're strapped for money to try to support these police forces, and they generate a good percentage of their annual budget by pulling people over through traffic stops, and the disconnect between white police forces and black residents has led to an incredible amount of tension.
Hi, Jeff. This is Lawrence Brown. I wanted to thank you for your article because you really honed in on how displacement and the loss of black land ownership led and fed into the what we're seeing in Ferguson today. What are your thoughts about the way that those two dynamics played out, the loss of black land ownership and the displacement of people, especially out of St. Louis public housing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, anytime you take a community and that's got a social fabric, an economic fabric, and, you know, a religious fabric, you know, sort of bound by churches, and you move everybody and you break it up and you say, you got to go somewhere else. Of course, that displacement is likely to lead to, you know, the various types of social dislocations that people are seeing across North County. So, clearly, this is intimately, you know, this frustration that we're seeing is intimately related to generations of, you know, of public policy that have disadvantaged blacks in North County.
Can you say that again? You said generations of public policy.
Yeah, generations of public policy, starting, you know, about a century ago when whites decided, you know, we don't want to be in the same town as you all blacks. And so you guys can have, you know, at first it was a noble experiment, Kinloch, this small town. It was a town where the first black in the state of Missouri got elected to a school board that governed a set of schools that were both black and white. The schools themselves weren't integrated, but they were in a district that was integrated, and that was unusual. However, over time, whites sort of asserted their primacy in the region and decided, you know, we want to be in charge of everything. You can have your own little town, but we're not going to be a part of it, and we're not going to, you know, share resources with you. So that was an original decision back nearly a century ago, which led to a series of decisions that continue to plague North St. Louis County today. And people who just look at images of somebody throwing a brick through a window on television don't understand that this is not something that just happened, that is just the result of a tragic killing last week.
Dr. Jeffrey Smith, I know you have to run, but I appreciate you being part of this program this morning. That's why we started with you. We know you only had a few minutes. And I want to welcome Dr. Clarence Lang, who's an incredible work. Clarence Lang, it's good to have you with us as well. Now, Jeff, if you can stay, please stay. If you can't, you know, we understand. You know, we just pulled over to join us.
Okay. I will. I can stay for about 5 more minutes.
Okay, cool. So, Clarence Lang, welcome. Good to have you with us here.
Thank you.
So also give us this perspective. I mean, this is, I think people look at Missouri and don't understand in some ways the deep sense of its segregationist past and how that plays into the present.
I can only amplify what the gentleman just said, and he's, I mean, he said it, I think, far more eloquently than I can, but, I mean, I'll say that the St. Louis metropolitan area has actually historically been a pioneer in residential segregation. So St. Louis City voters there in 1916 were the first to pass a housing segregation ordinance through popular referendum and ballot. St. Louis pioneered in the creation of restrictive housing covenants, gated private streets, post-World War II zoning laws. And so there's a long and very very notorious history of racial segregation. And so it's no surprise that you have communities like Ferguson or Kinloch, as the gentleman referred to earlier, where you have not just simply spatial segregation and isolation, but that also comes along with economic abandonment. And part of why you have, I think, so many of these municipalities in that region, I mean, that's part of sort of the history of the area in the 19th century, but it also is a way of white St. Louisans, people in the area, of severing themselves from communities of color. And so there are all these kinds of, as you said, policy, long-standing policy legacies that are involved here that are hidden if we just simply look at what people are doing in the streets. And if I could, can I just quickly add this point?
Please do. Go ahead.
Okay. I mean, to put it in another context as well, I've been thinking a lot these days about the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, otherwise known as the Kerner Commission, in 1968. Where policymakers were trying to figure out the same thing that people are discussing today. What explains these rash of black urban disturbances after 1967? And in 68, there's this report. And what they found is that while an act of police violence or excessive force was the match that lit the powder keg, so to speak. The powder keg actually had been stuffed by a number of longstanding issues having to do with people feeling that their city government did not represent them or was not responsive, that they didn't have access to public amenities. They had grievances around employment, housing, schools, these general kinds of concerns about the lack of meaningful opportunity and mobility. And so to bring that forward, I think we have the same issue today. So if we scratch the surface, if we look beyond, obviously this is about the fact that someone was killed under very hazy and questionable circumstances. But underlying all of that are these longstanding grievances about racial profiling, about employment, about economic opportunity, about quality housing, about schooling. And so we don't understand what's occurring right now if we don't understand it in that larger context having to do with the St. Louis metro area, but also the context that includes other urban areas around the nation, because indeed this could have happened anywhere.
Just really quickly, I have you all comment on this email that came in. Dr. Joanne Martin and our late husband, Dr. Elmer Martin, co-founded the Great Blacks and Wax Museum. And what she wrote in was, he has passed away. What you don't know is that he is a Missouri-born and bred. The schools in his hometown, 2 hours from St. Louis, desegregated in 1959 as a result of the Brown decision. In the 6 years since Brown, there has never been a black teacher in Glasgow, Missouri schools. Is there any wonder that Elmer delivered a commencement speech there before a class where they had no black graduates? In high school, when Elmer selected to do his term paper on Booker T. Washington, his teacher responded that she could not think of anything a black man had ever done that he could write about. And she was certain there was nothing a black man had ever done that she wanted to read about. There's a toxic climate there that sends young blacks away either to some other city or to prison. I'm from a small town in Florida, so I have no cause to gloat. I just know that my husband would feel very connected to the despair and anguish playing itself out in Ferguson right now. And thank you for continuing to be the messenger, Dr. Joanne Martin. So I just wanted to share her thoughts as another Missourian. We've been hearing a lot from people who grew up in Missouri. And I know there's nothing special. I'll start with Clarence Lang, and then if Jeff can stay, we'll go to Jeff, and then back to my co-host to come out with his thought as well. So in looking at the nature of Missouri and the South and the history of Missouri from Dred Scott on and the Civil War and to where we are now, I mean, is there something different about Missouri than Kansas or Illinois or Maryland?
I would argue, I mean, my research, my work has told me, and that would be a different experience having lived there. I mean, I lived there for some time. But the thing that always struck me about St. Louis and Missouri more generally is that it does exist in this kind of in-between space. So if you ask the average St. Louisan on the street, is St. Louis in the South or the Midwest? Actually, I've done this, and I found that you get a number of different kinds of responses. So it is, in some ways, it's close to Illinois. I mean, there's a sense of it being Midwestern, but there's also this very, if you will, kind of Southern kind of historical legacy as well. Missouri was a slave state, and so the legacies of that are sort of in play, but yet, at the same time, African Americans were part of the voting public. And so they were able to exercise certain kinds of influence. So there's a long tradition of black elected officialdom in the state and in St. Louis. So what you have is this collision of social, economic, political, and cultural influences, heritages, and legacies that are both northern and Southern, in the same way that Missouri and St. Louis were also a transition point between the East and the West. That would be my argument. And how that plays itself out in this particular instance, I'm not sure that's as pertinent here.
Right.
Because this could have been Detroit. I mean, it could have been any place. But if we think about the larger historical context, St. Louis has always been, in my mind, this very interesting, uneven mix of politics and economics that are akin to both the North and the South. That would be my argument.
Jeff, do you have any thoughts?
Jeff had to hang up. Jeff ran. He could only be with us for a little bit.
Well, you know, I think it could be anywhere to your question, Mark, because what we're looking at in America is the changing demography of poverty.
Yes.
And in a lot of urban areas, you have gentrification, the invocation of eminent domain, the dismantling of public housing.
Right.
So it couldn't. The funny thing is everybody's mentioning Detroit, Philadelphia, Baltimore. It could be those cities. No, what it will be are cities like Owings Mills, Reisterstown, these suburban areas, the frontline suburbs around America's largest urban areas. Auburn Hills are Auburn's not close to Detroit, but the places out surrounding the urban areas, those are the places where this is going to happen next, because you have disaffected, displaced, disenfranchised black people that have been pushed out.
Yeah.
And the National Commission on Urban Problems, another report that was generated by Senator Paul Douglas out of Illinois in 68, he mentioned that really that the cause of those riots was the instability in housing. You had urban renewal, highway construction, these massive federal, state, and local projects that pushed millions of black people out of their homes, and that was a rising, and it still is, because of the same dynamics, cause of frustration leading to conflagration.
And before we go to break, yeah, Dr. Lang, could you give us a closing thought on what you just heard and your thoughts as we wind up this segment?
Yes. No, I was going to say ditto. I mean, I think the point is that, I mean, having grown up in Chicago, these dynamics are playing themselves out in that metropolitan area as well. I think you make a very brilliant point, if I can say that, that I think we do have to think about how poverty is being displaced, and that, in fact, you have development occurring in central cities, and that, in fact, racialized poverty is being transplanted to these older inner ring suburbs. And so I think you make a very interesting point about how we have to think about our assumptions about what it is to live in the suburbs is not the same as what we would have assumed post-World War II.
Well, I think, you know, Dr. Lang, I'm really glad we discovered you and your work, Dr. Clarence Lang. And we look forward to having you back. I look forward to hearing a great deal more about your notions about class politics and the black freedom struggle. From what I've been reading that you've written in the past, it's fascinating stuff. So
thank you.
I hope you'll rejoin us one day soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Clarence Lang is Associate Professor of African and African-American Studies and American Studies at the University of Kansas, Associate Editor of the Journal of African-American History, and author of Grassroots of the Gateway, Class Politics and Black Freedom Struggle in St. Louis from 1936 to 75, and co-editor of Anti-Communism and the African-American Freedom Movement, Another Side of the Story. So we look forward to having Dr. Lang with us again very soon to really talk about our history and how it feeds into our future. We're going to take a very brief break. We're going to go to break here with The Eve of Destruction by Barry McGuire, released on this day in 1965, became a huge hit with people who were in the movement during that period, and many soldiers as well. Dr. Lawrence Brown and I will be right back. When we return, we will be joined by State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal from Ferguson, Missouri. Stay with us.
We're on the eve of destruction.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'm with Dr. Lawrence Brown, our co-host here for this hour. And we continue our look at Ferguson, and we are lucky and honored to have with us at this moment State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, who is a state senator from St. Louis County District 14 and has been out at the protest since the beginning, since this happened in her district and among her people. And, Senator, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we look forward to having you all with us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. You know, one of the things that's always struck us, and I want Lawrence Brown to leap in here right after this, one of the things that really struck me is that the real story that's going on in Ferguson is actually happening in the Twitter feed world. Where the stories are coming out from the people actually there. There are two sets of stories here.
Yes, you're right. There are two sets of stories, almost like a tale of two cities.
Right. Mm. So talk about what you think people are missing in the greater media from not hearing your voice and the voice of others who are there every day.
Well, the one thing I will tell you, yes, I have been on the ground since day one, and I actually say day one is the day that Mike Brown was killed by an officer. And I will tell you that these young people, they're hurting. These are young folks who have been intimidated, harassed, beaten with phone books. And this is prior to the death of Michael Brown. And when they knew that their neighborhood buddy was killed, when they found that out or witnessed it or saw his body, it just brought up all of these feelings of intimidation and terror that they had been feeling for years in their young life. And prior to this, again, a lot of these young people, I would say, have post-traumatic stress just because of their lives being wow. undereducated, being impoverished, not having access to jobs, multiple things going on. And so at the end of the day when Mike was killed, they see themselves as Michael Brown. Wrong place, wrong time, they are Michael Brown. And so that's the onset. That's what where all of the heat and just anger initially started. That's where everyone was in the community as well. And then, unfortunately, we had some outside individuals. You know, this is part of the story that is really not heard a lot. There are people who came in, revolutionaries or extremists from all over the country, and they were part of this whole looting of businesses. And it really wasn't people from Ferguson, but people who wanted to draw attention and then also have, attack the police officers and other government officials. And so that is underreported. From that point, that was Sunday, you go to Monday, and I'm out protesting with the young people, complete strangers in many cases, but we're family members now because we've been together for 13 days now. And, we were blamed for what the looters did. And, I'm not a looter. And the 150 young people who lived in the apartments along West Florissant that I was protesting with, I felt completely comfortable. None of them had guns. None of them had knives. Just a peaceful protest to try to get out all of this anger that they had been experiencing. And so what came of that, I told my intern who was with me that day, if you see the police officers start moving, we need to go to the car. So we didn't even get, which was just around the corner, we didn't even have enough time to get from being on the street protesting right along the sidewalk to the car before they started throwing tear gas. And the street that we were on was a one-way street, one way in, one way out, and the police officers started spraying this tear gas or throwing tear gas at us. And we were trying to say, we can't get out. We'll leave, but we can't get out. And because they're not from, many of these police officers were from St. Louis County and not in Ferguson, they didn't realize that this was a one-way street. And so they kept saying, go out the other way, go out the other way. And there were cars lined up like I was who were saying, we can't go out the wrong way. And then they kept throwing tear gas. For 3 hours, they were throwing tear gas. I'm one of the most courageous people that you'll ever know, seriously. Like, I've been going up against the governor, and it's nothing new.
We've seen some of your tweets.
He's in my party, and I'll get to him later. But, we had rubber bullets shot at us, and there's some people wounded. But here's the distressing story, one of many, is that there was a six-month pregnant woman who was forced, she was lined up in her car trying to get out too, and she was forced face down to the ground, pregnant, while we were being tear gassed. And she was trying to explain, we can't get out, I'd like to leave, but we can't get out. And they forced her face down. Now, what you don't know is the St. Louis County police officer said, well, we give a 30-minute advance. Well, excuse me, not day one, two, or three, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of last week. No, they did not. They just immediately got to shooting the rubber bullets and also, shooting us with tear gas. And so that was so unfortunate. I was so nervous and scared. I was hyperventilating. I couldn't breathe. And I've been in Iraq. In 2010, I was in Iraq. I was a international observer, and we wanted to just see how elections went. And we were fired upon and had to get in a bunker for like an hour and a half. And I'll tell you, what we experienced last week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, was everything you hear about in the United States. And we were being treated as if we were Iraqi insurgents. We literally were being shot at with weaponry that you would use if you're in Afghanistan or Iraq, but it's St. Louis County police officers who are treating residents like this. So let me get to the governor. The governor was at the state fair all of these first 3 days of last week, and not until there was international attention did he say, oh, I'm going to take a break and leave the state fair and come pay attention to my constituents who happen to be black and live in a minority community, impoverished community, if you will. And not until there was national, international attention did he come. But I had already been tear gassed twice by that time. So, yeah, I sent out some tweets, and I don't regret anything I said. And my constituents backed me up on that, which is wonderful. But they, too, were victims. And so this whole thing, I told my constituents from the onset, as long as you're out here protesting, I'm going to be out here protesting. So I've been up since a little bit before 4 a.m. Wow. I was at my first site at 6 a.m. And now I'm still out in a different location out protesting and just trying to raise awareness on this whole ordeal. So there's a lot that's going on, but this whole thing is about young people being intimidated. And it's not just so much black and white. Yes, there is racism, but it's institutional racism within the Ferguson Police Department as well as the St. Louis County Police Department. But this community, this is the first death all year. This is the first shooting all year. And I would like to say, I had a couple of constituents, one of which I went to high school with. She told me yesterday that it has been a matter of years since there's been a shooting. And so knowing that it's a peaceful community where black and white, we socialize together, go drinking together, go to the movies together, you know, just have fun. But it is a fact that this police department has more arrests of African Americans than any other group, number one. And two, there are reports of discrimination a long time.
So let me, Dr. Lawrence Brown, have a question. We have a lot of callers calling in. We want to get to their voices as well. But go ahead, Lawrence.
Senator Chappelle Nadal, thank you for your work. You mentioned the police. What is it that needs to happen in Ferguson when you look at the fact that the police department is over 94% white, the community's almost 70% black? Doesn't that speak to a racial dynamic that needs to be addressed, especially in terms of governance and policing?
Oh, absolutely. You're totally correct. And, you know, I don't like to use this excuse, but it is the reality. We have lower voter turnout among the African-American community, but also the population in Ferguson among African-Americans is more of the younger age people than the older. Just looking at my Senate district, I have about 12,000 households or 13,000 households that are frequent voters, not individual people, but households. And only 1,000 of all of that are people who are under the age of 40. So just look at those dynamics. And because the African-American community is younger in Ferguson, you don't have the high rates of voting. And so, and that adds to having a city council that is a majority white. Mm-hmm. There's only one African-American. And then it also adds, because you don't have people aggressively seeking a diverse police department and no one ever questioning, that's a problem. So
what are the solutions that you and others in elected office, what solutions have been pushed or will be pushed in light of this to equalize and to bring about equity in representation?
Well, here's what we're doing, long-term, short-term, and it's what I call the phase two, because we are protesting, but we need to get to the next phase, which is, you know, having solutions, as you stated, and action items. So the first thing is, I'm just trying to get these young people to go to city council, know who their representatives are on city council and the mayor, have communication ongoing. The next thing is that we've been talking, and we've been successful, we've been talking about diversifying the police department, and the mayor came out yesterday and said that is going to be one of his initiatives, which we're very happy about. But the other thing is, I think every single officer right now, regardless of what his or her experience has been, needs to have some diversity training, because obviously there's a hidden problem in Ferguson. And it, again, going back to what I said from the onset, this is a tale of two cities. Some people just like to have the perception that everything is hunky-dory, but it's not. There are people who are enraged, and they feel as though they don't have a place to verbalize or communicate that they are frustrated with the abuse and intimidation. But the next thing is, which a lot of departments do, is have police officers have precincts and neighborhoods that they go to, and instead of having a relationship built off of mistrust, we need to work on having genuine relationships based off of trust and build bridges from that perspective. And always, go ahead.
No, just saying, I'm going to bring a caller in here, but I also have a question just about the political process in Ferguson. But let me get a caller in here first to join us at 410-319-8888. Michael Scott from Equity Matters, you're on the air.
Hey, folks, and Senator, glad to hear from you. I'm going to suggest to you that if you do diversity training, you're going to have diversely trained racists. You'll have culturally competent racists. What you need is anti-racism training to deal with the structural inequalities and institutional racism that you discussed. And I would encourage you also to really look at, you know, what do the oath keepers look like in your city, in your state? So that concerns us as well. And we're starting to see what we get when we have this over-militarization. All this equity stuff that we're talking here and laws just raised is really about, you know, who these policies, who these laws protect. Do they count for us? And what we see over and over in every community is that they do not count for poor folks and folks of color. So I'm gonna applaud you for holding your senior party elected officials accountable and charge you with trying to look at the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, you know, unmatched with respect to training, anti-racism in agencies all over the country. It has actually evidence-based. And look at Joyce James in Texas and how all these systems on and off-ramp each other from juvenile justice to education, because you really need an evidence-based approach that works, an evidence-based approach to frame the analysis so that folks can't, you know, wiggle out of it talking about it personally mediated when the structural and institutional evidence is so overwhelming. And so Joyce James and People's Institute, I'm going to recommend to you.
Thank you.
Michael Scott, it's always good to hear from you. There's two important questions here before we go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. And one of them is, and Lawrence, I want you to come back in as well, thoughts on this. Why is it that in a majority African-American community of Ferguson, mm-hmm. almost all the elected officials are white? How did that happen? Why is it happening? Could you explain that to us?
Well, you know.
Yeah, because people aren't voting.
That's it?
That's a big part of it, just being passive. You know, a lot of people are comfortable in their expression, their political expression, and just think that other folks, the older folks, are always going to take care of who should be elected and who should not. But this passiveness is, needs to go away, and we have to get politically active. But let me tell you the good news. The good news is everyone in this community is ready to do a recall. And so they're investigating on how to do a recall of the mayor and certain council people. They want to have the police chief fired. And so they're ready. They're doing stuff that they've never done before. And that's the great part of it. It's just we want to make sure that it's organized and our objectives are clear and we get to the outcomes that we desire. So this sort of thing does not reoccur.
Again, to your question, Mark, you know, why is it this way and why can't anything be done about it? I think we have to go back and look at the loss of that all-black town, Kinloch, the expansion of the airport that resulted in the loss of black land ownership, the displacement of the older folks in that community to Ferguson, and now their children are rising up. Because what you have is historical trauma that has impacted a population over the course of generations, as our guest said earlier. And there isn't a lot of a lot of our solutions only deal with what we see in front of us, but don't deal with the historical trauma that has happened to people intergenerationally. And so if you have an intergenerational problem, you have to have intergenerational solutions.
Yes, so, that's right.
And the other question, today on Fox News, maybe it was last year on Fox News, reported that the officer who shot Michael Brown was severely beaten by Michael Brown before the incident. Do we know the veracity of that? Do you know anything about that?
I've never heard the term severely, and the I haven't heard of that. I heard that he had injuries, but we've not seen any proof. We just don't know, so I can't substantiate that at all.
Well, I mean, the reason I only asked that is I didn't know if you could or could not, but I, you know, when people that when it is put out there on very conservative media that this happened, I just, you know, we try here to kind of get to the truth of stuff, no matter how, whether it supports what we think or not. And that's why I was trying to figure out whether that was real, whether it was not real. This is an eye socket was broken. They put all this stuff out in Fox News. And we don't know the reality yet, though.
Yeah, absolutely. The grand jury started meeting yesterday, and they're going to get a lot of evidence in. And, you know, we're just going to have to see it. What this community cares about is full transparency of everything and no tampering with any of the evidence, because they have a lot of questions and they have a huge mistrust for the judicial process. And I have to carry that through in everything that I say. For example, we want the prosecuting attorney in St. Louis County to recuse himself. Unfortunately, it's in the governor's hands. The governor historically has not been a huge advocate of the African-American community. So, you know, we have to do what we have to do. But this group of people that I'm with every single day, young people especially, and others from this community, they're not going to stop protesting because they are Michael Brown. And you just put them in the wrong circumstances at any given time, and they're going to feel the same anger. And they just simply do not want to be part of any negativity or violence again. So they're right. Becoming active. Obviously, you can tell I'm out protesting. Everyone's honking as they go by.
Well, and State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, it's been great to have you with us, and I look forward to having you back on again in the coming week as this unfolds. So thank you so much for your work and for being out there with the people.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay.
Before we hear about the protests that happened in Baltimore,
you know, I want to go back to the point that Michael Scott made about diversity training. I think that's very important. One thing that I think we haven't discussed are the psychology of police interactions with black men. And what the research tells us is that we have everything from implicit racial bias to masculinity threat to anti-black dehumanization at play. And what those terms mean is this: implicit racial bias are biases that people have that are subconscious, that are often automatic, hidden. Even people that, white folks that claim to be egalitarian, can harbor biases about black people. And we know that the biases and stereotypes about black men are that they're animals, brutish, thugs, violent, innately. And so if those are the stereotypes that are lurking beneath the surface within a power dynamic of an officer that's encountering a black male, and you hear these things like, you know, like you mentioned, I believe on another show, you know, that they have this super strength. You know, they just wouldn't go down. These beliefs about black people, that black people have a higher pain threshold.
Right, right.
So all of these things and stereotypes play into this notion of, well, I need to levy more violence and use more deadly force to disable, disarm, and kill this particular person because I don't view them in many ways as human, but as an animal. And what do with animals? You put them down. So the diversity training is, to Michael's point, not enough. You have to have that understanding of what stereotypes and biases about black people, the portrayals in media, have been historically. You would have to have a real discussion about bias and stereotypes to or even get there. Masculinity threat is when a man feels like his manhood is being threatened or his ego is being assaulted or basically somebody's challenging his manhood. And what does the research tell us? That when someone challenges your manhood, men across the board, what we do is that we resort to manhood restoration behavior. So if you're going to punk me, oh, no, I got to do something to let you know. I'm still a man. I'm still in charge. Well, what happens when the police, when their manhood is threatened? They want to assert their masculinity like anybody else.
And there's a whole other level, though, to me that I think that we don't have time to do today. We only have a couple minutes left in this segment, but 90 seconds, I'm just being told. But it's the question of police and power. And there has to be a dynamic shift in America to lead the way to change the nature of policing, period.
Right.
In terms of how we police our communities. You know, the small town officer friendly has become this mythology that we believe in. And I think we have to really arrest with that. And I hope we can do that in the coming days. First of all, I want to thank, it's always phenomenal to have you with us here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.